On today's episode of Family Flowers Only, I talk to Peter Mahoney, a therapist specialising in grief in his own practice called By Your Side Therapy. In May 2019, Peter's world was rocked when he received a phone call to tell him that his brother Andrew, a popular talented musician and Voice of Ireland star, had died by suicide. We spoke about what led up to that point, the endless questions after, the coroner's court, how his family found meaning since losing Andrew, and the gift of therapy. This is an important conversation and one that I hope you will take with you. Hi, Peter.
Hiya.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Great,
great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Not at all, it's great.
At short notice.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that.
Yeah.
Sometimes the spontaneous quick ones are really good.
I know, straight into it.
Thank you.
And I know that you were on a good friend of mine, Sheila's Show Against Podcast before in 2020. So is this your next, have you done one since?
No, this is the next venture of the podcast. Which is great, yeah, so thank you.
So I know you spoke on that one a lot about therapy. So you are a therapist yourself.
Yes.
And you spoke quite a lot about therapy and the benefits of it. And I know on that podcast, you touched on your own loss of your brother, Andrew. And so obviously our podcast today is all about grief and loss and all of that. So I'm so privileged that you've come in to share your story with us. And I always like to go back, and tell me all about your person. So I suppose, where are you from yourself? You're from Dublin originally?
Yeah, born and reared South County Dublin.
That's, okay.
We've moved a few times. So there's mum and dad. I've got two older sisters. And then I had three younger brothers. So Andrew was the next from me after he was 4 years after me. And then there's two other brothers.
Big family.
Yeah, five of us. When there's mum and dad, their children, partners, grandchildren and great grandchildren, there's 42 of us just in that. So we're a big family.
Yeah. I'd love that.
It's great fun. It's great
central.
Fun. Absolutely. When there's a barbecue during the summer and then the Christmas party,
it's great.
It is great fun and we're all very close. So born and reared there, I was third. So Andrew and myself used to kind of battle off who was the middle child.
Oh.
Who could claim the middle child, because there was two ahead of me and there was two behind him. We very kind of normal. Dad was a fireman. It was great. Mum was able to stay at home. We all did school, college, different courses. So it was kind of, to me, very kind of normal.
Absolutely.
Very, very normal. Nothing out of the out of the blue or out of the ordinary in any way in our family life. And I had, like that with family, you kind of share rooms back and forth with different people over the years. And there was one time three brothers were in a room together, and you know how we survived that, we did. But there was a few years where Andrew and myself shared a room. It was wonderful because, well, part of it was wonderful. But at that time, he was learning to play the guitar. I'd say he was about, he must have been about 8 or 9. And a friend of ours took him under the wing and said, look, you know, would you try a few chords? And he went for lessons. And you know those early weeks and months where it's cringe and cat claws down the chalkboard?
I was just thinking cat came to mind there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That kind of, and the strumming was a bit off. Painful for a while, but oh, my goodness, years later, it was just music was always for him. And he just kind of sharpened his gift and really just loved it. So I can claim, my only claim to fame is that I remember him when he was bad and then as he got really, really good. And he really, got, like as some of us were getting married and having kids, Andrew was just kind of trailblazing this career of music. And I think I was thinking about it today coming in. I was going, you know, there's Taylor Swift and there's Coldplay and there's, you know, four nights and adding extra nights and race for tickets, and I'm going, Andrew would have loved that. He would have loved to have four nights in Croke Park and then an extra date, just that he loved performing.
Tell me, what kind of a guy was he? You know, even as kids growing up, was he cheeky chappy? Was he quiet, reserved, deep thinker? What was he like?
He, you know, kind of pre-mid-teens, just that typical second middle child. And just out and about in school, We cycled places together. We kicked ball together. It's funny, our family is kind of split down the middle. There's half of us have dad's gene pool and half have mum's gene pool. So like if you were to have met Andrew, he's nothing like me. You would never think we were brothers. So Andrew and my sister and a couple of them come from mum's, you know, thin, kind of the dark hair, completely different build, and the rest of our dad's kind of more broad and tall. So if Andrew was sitting here beside me, there's no way we were brothers. He has tattoos. He developed, like, he had a feather earring. He wore kind of the Stetson hat, the leather gear, like totally different. But I think he just, growing up, he was just Andrew. He was just the younger brother, played music, a huge pool of friends. But even those friends kind of developed kind of like a band together and played music. Didn't really enjoy school. Right. In fact, looking around my siblings, I don't think any of us loved school. I think we were happy to get out of it.
Creative, much
more creative. And Andrew certainly was out of all of us. Was like there's finance people in there, there's health people in there, there's farmers in there, there's you know, brilliant craftsmen in there. So I'm a therapist. So we're a right mixed bunch.
It's funny, isn't it, when you think of a household like that, grown up, and you have five. Totally different. I see with my own child now, you know, from such a young age, you can see that personality. You can see it, and it doesn't have to be anything like the siblings. They're just, everyone's so different.
Yeah.
So yourself and Andrew, did you get on? Were you close when your teenage years and, you know, let's say when he started to turn 20, 21, 22, all that kind of period of his life when he leaves school age. And were you guys close?
We were always close as a family. We'd always, even though we had very different interests, we were always close. And this is where I claim the middle child, because when I was doing my therapy training, because that's what I am by trade, I kind of was the youngest of two older sisters and the eldest of four brothers. And I just remember times where Andrew and my two younger brothers would go off skiing together or on holidays together. And I was already kind of a bit too old to be doing that. So as we grew older, I wouldn't say distance came in. I think our interests just got different. As we got older, we separated just purely geographically. I think we were always kind of still close and in each other's lives. But I suppose I married young, started my family young. So my time and energies kind of went into that. Mum and dad were always brilliant at bringing the family together.
Right.
So Sunday afternoons were mum and dad's house or our house or my sister's house. But mum and dad were great at gathering the family. So you might see people for a month or 2 weeks or 2 months or 3 months, and all of a sudden we all be in mum and dad's house. And
it was important to them.
Really, really important. And our children have really benefited from that time as well, just kind of seeing the wider family. So close, always close. Interests became different.
Yeah.
And Andrew's life went off this way and my life went off that way. But
you just came back. So Andrew then obviously pursued this passion and love for music. So what did that look like for him? What did he kind of do with that? Was he hoping to go professional? And
absolutely. Like if you think of the deep end of a pool, he jumped in deep end.
Wow.
Like I remember some Sundays we would all be in mum and dad's, and maybe about 5 o'clock, Andrew would have his van all packed up and he'd be going to meet the lads. He'd be doing a gig at 6. He'd be doing another gig at 9. And then be heading into town to do another gig at 11. And he loved it, absolutely loved it. So he really threw himself in deep. And we joked back in 2013, I was training for the marathon and Andrew was gigging all over the place. And we used to joke because at that time, he was even actually in friend's house across the road from us. He was renting a room there. And we used to laugh at each other because I'd sometimes be heading out at 5 o'clock in the morning and he'd be coming back. Like he might have been singing in Mayo or Galway or whatever, and he'd be coming back and we'd crisscross each other. So we said, we should actually probably have breakfast together. It's the only time we're probably
like
both
sliding
up.
Doors.
Exactly.
Two different lives.
Totally different. Yeah. So that's why we didn't see a lot of each other, even though he literally was 100 yards across the road from me. So he threw himself in big time. Yes. I think for Andrew, the dream was always to go big. He did The Voice of Ireland. He went for the Eurovision.
Confident guy then.
Confident guy. But I think he put himself out there and the knocks, I think, began to get to him.
Sure.
I wonder whether or not some of the questions of, you know, will this ever happen for me? And then he begins just to get a little bit older. And you fall into kind of a maybe different genre or age bracket and the appeal. But he was, even as a 40-year-old performing, he still felt he was maybe the 25-year-old, and he certainly had the energy of a 25-year-old, you know, performing. So I think in time, I think some of the decisions went against him. Mm-hmm. Frangio, it was, I think it was just a very gradual, slow decline or realization of, will this ever happen? Will this ever work?
Yeah, so like so many in the music industry, it's my own brother played guitar and he had a dream for a while, you know, they were supporting in festivals and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it's not clear cut where if you work hard in an office and there's a path and there's a ladder to climb, that it's really a mixture of talent and luck, really.
Yeah, big time.
And when you're pinning your hopes on luck, it's like pinning your hope in the lottery, really, a lot of the times, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there is, I suppose, a lot of room for letdown and, you know, it takes a certain type of person to keep pursuing that and to keep going with that. Mm-hmm. So in his own kind of life, he had... in his personal life, he had a child then.
That's right. Yes. Early on, he had a son.
Yeah.
Now, down in Cork, a lot. He's up and down to us, to my grandparents, and spends a lot of time with my brother.
And so was he thrilled to be a dad?
Oh, he was. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It was great. It was really, really good. And a great addition to the family, you know, his son was. But there was still that tension in Andrew of, delighted to be a dad. Great to be a dad. But he still wanted this lifestyle. Yeah. So he was trying to, you know, straddle both at the same time. So, you know, trying to get up and down to Cork as often to see him, and then his son coming up to Dublin to spend time with as well. His son idolized him. Like, you know, he really did. They had a great relationship, very close relationship. You're right, Andrew. Like, for me, growing up, soccer was my game. Often people would say, God, I'm surprised you never got to England and stuff. And I was going, look, there was thousands of me in Dublin who might have been good, but we were never going to get picked. It is that luck. And I think even though I know when The Voice, the four judges have to turn, all four judges turned, and he went with the person he wanted to go
to. See, I didn't know this. I didn't follow. What year was this?
Oh, that would have been, I'd say 2016, 17 maybe.
Right. So I suppose to slow it down for anyone that's listening at home. So the Voice is a singing competition in Ireland.
Absolutely.
On TV.
Yeah.
So he put himself forward.
And you have to do kind of early kind of auditions and stages. And then you are invited to go onto the stage and sing, and the four judges have their back turned to you. And you're hoping that at least one will turn and pick you. I think you have to have at least one to be picked. So I think Andrew was about four lines into the song and all the judges turned.
You're serious?
Yeah,
oh,
and you could see the look on his face.
Where were you guys? You watch it, was this pre-recorded?
My dad and his son were actually in watching it. It was pre-recorded. Wow. So then I think a few weeks later it came out and we were all sitting there.
God, that must have been amazing.
It was an amazing moment, especially to see when all four turned, his face just changed. He was still singing, because you have to keep singing, but you could see the smile on his face. I've got all four. And then their comments back to him, like, I know Andrea Corr was one of them. And, you know, she was, oh, please pick me, please pick me. And he went with another judge and stuff like that. And that's what I mean. He got so close. But then it's dependent on people picking up the phone and ringing and voting for you.
Such an exciting time, I suppose, for your family and stuff. Like, your mum and dad must have been bursting with pride, were they?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, we all were. Yeah. And we were all, I think all 42 of us at the time were kind of, you know, trying to push him over the line, because we knew what it meant to him. We really knew that, and kind of going for the Eurovision. And I think he was up against two brothers who were big celebrities, and they got picked. But like in the room, we were all sitting there going, look.
No doubt in your mind.
Well, no doubt in our mind. But again, there are many brilliant musicians in this city alone.
Again, like I say, it's luck, isn't it?
It's
luck. A flip of a coin.
Yeah. And he, I think Andrew's story is in some fields, he definitely got there and got great recognition. But that big break, I never came his way. Mm-hmm. And I think that just kind of hit deep inside him. I think the human spirit, it's very resilient, but I think it can only take so many knocks.
Sure.
And he got into a new relationship and had a beautiful little baby girl as well. Aww. So there were other good things in his life, and family was still very much in his life. But this big part of the pie for him of career was starting, and it was always kind of maybe the next thing and maybe the next thing were happening, and all of a sudden it kind of wasn't happening. And I think that took its toll in some ways on Andrew a little bit.
And yeah, like we said there, it's like because of the specific career, it's like, when do you stop? When do you when is enough enough? When do you think, okay, it's not going to happen, I'm not going to make it big or whatever, you know? Chatting about Andrew and his life and what he was like and stuff, his health, did you see anything in, I suppose, his mental health? Did you see a decline in that?
I think there was probably a few factors. One, maybe not the big break happening. And again, you know, he's my brother and I love him and loved him dearly. But some of the decisions he made were interesting decisions. And some relationships you have with ex-partners and it just mightn't have been the best or the healthiest one. And so that was a big strain there. The way personally I would describe it is that they could love each other as much as they could hate each other. The same day. Two wonderful people, well matched in some ways and not matched in other ways. And so that was kind of a turbulent time, you know, for Andrew as well, straddling, you know, caring for his son in Cork and the relationship there, caring for his daughter and ex-partner, and just managing those real life things, that have to happen on a daily basis while trying to do the music. So I think what happened was the blows kept coming, and then unfortunately in February 2019 his ex-partner, she lost her life to suicide. And that's when it first visited our door. You have really clear memories. I remember at the time where I was working and I was happened to be with my dad, and he got the phone call and he just left work, and I was left to rest going, what the hell does that mean? Like, what the hell does that mean now for Andrew, for the family? Like, we had never, yes, we might have experienced the death of maybe grandparents or our elderly relatives, but this? What do you do with this piece? And then kind of trying to rally around Andrew.
You're worried about him?
Absolutely. Because again, in some cases with suicide, the police have to be involved. So awkward questions have to be asked, and people interviewed. And what about this? And, you know, I think when you're one or two of the last people to have seen the person, they ask you, purely just from an inquiry point of view, did you notice anything? What was going on? So that was February, and Andrew, the only way I would describe it is a spiral staircase, and it was a step and a step. He didn't just kind of jump off the edge. It was just an eroding away of, I think maybe some people have placed blame on him for this. He was trying to figure it out. He was now trying to figure out looking after a young daughter. So his head was just a little bit over the place. The family, my parents in particular, and my next oldest sister, and all of us really kind of rallied around just to make sure he was okay. But it began to get worse.
And so I presume you were all beside yourselves with worry.
More so, I was worried about him.
Right.
But it never crossed my mind that he'd do what he'd do. You kind of go, God, he's in a dark place. I wonder how this is going to play.
So you were thinking, right, we need to get him through this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he had spent time he was hospitalized for a while in an institution just to kind of give him the break. That was a disaster. That didn't work for him. Okay. It didn't work for him. What Andrew needed towards the end of his own life, what he really needed was a place just to, excuse the French, verbal diarrhea.
Yeah.
Just to talk. And that particular facility, they had supports, but they weren't for him.
Yeah, sure.
They might have been
case
kind of
by case.
Yeah, art therapy or a bit of this. He found solace with the chaplain. Now, faith was kind of part of my life, and was kind of part of the family life. And then it kind of drifted around with different people. And it wasn't really a big part of Andrew's life. But in the place, he struck up a brilliant relationship with the chaplain.
Wow.
And that's what he needed from the professionals, was just able to get it off his chest. And again, you know, with suicide, there's so many questions left. You go, if he had had that, would it have been different? If he could have just talked and cared for, would it have been different? And you don't do that with family. You need to do that kind of outside of family in some ways. Family are there in a different way.
So when he was struggling, you know, after all the loss that he had seen with his ex-partner and whatnot, was he talking to you guys in this time afterwards? Was he saying, I'm not doing well here? Or was he very much I'm not doing well, but I'm not going to talk about it. Let me get on with it.
I think a bit of both. There was an element of getting on with it. He was staying on and off with my parents at the time, so they were really involved. And my younger brother and older sister were very much there with them as well. They were more concerned, and when it came really towards the end, they were the one who took him to the GP and then got him into the hospital for help and care, and they were much more aware of that. One or two of us were kind of more in the background of that. We were aware that things weren't great, but again, you were just thinking, of course, this is just bottoming out for him, and it'll come back up again.
But you're thinking, of course, it's not great. Like, he's had a big, his child's mother has, lost her life, and of course you think, well, this is normal that he's going to struggle with this, and there's a lot going on, and I suppose it's normal, isn't it, for you to think, okay, he's struggling here and I am worried, but at the same time, we'll get him through this. It's just a patch of his life.
It's just a patch. It's just the darkest part out of all that he's been through and experienced. This is the darkest, and there's enough of us to get through him, get through it with him, and he'll come out the other end, and he'll, the grief of the ex-partner will pass, and the turbulence that all of that brought, it'll all pass, and he'll come back to the middle ground again. We'll all be okay, and it'll be something we live with and kind of, have to incorporate into life. But that didn't happen,
So can you tell me, I suppose, what did happen next?
May 2019 is a month I will never forget. It started off, I was at a soccer tournament on the May Bank Holiday weekend. And I promised my wife I'd only play goalkeeper and wouldn't get injured. Famous last words. First game, playing goalkeeper, I stepped back and completely snapped my Achilles tendon.
Oh God.
So on the Monday morning, surgery on the ankle, in a cast, whole readjust for Kira, for the family. It's a 12-week injury, and our daughter was getting married in 10 weeks. And I was determined to work her down the aisle. So I had to gain 2 weeks back. So there was all of that going on in our own personal home. We were planning a wedding, readjustment for me with the leg, hobbling around, crutches and hospital visits. So for us and our family, a bit of a mental shift. Then 3 weeks later, I was doing an assignment actually on grief, believe it or not. And it was a Saturday morning, the 19th of May. I was at the table kind of sorting it all out, and Kira is brilliant. She's a whiz in the computer, and she was tidying it all up and everything. And it's about lunchtime, and I had my leg up on the chair and trying to get rested and all that. And all of a sudden, phone rang, and Dad's number came up, and I answered it. And he goes, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, he said, he's gone. I said, "What?" I said, he hung himself. And I just dropped the phone. And I bawled my eyes out for about 15, 20 minutes. And Kira was like, what's going on here? So she had to pick up the phone and finish the call with my dad. So that was, I've only cried 3 times. And I'll tell you about the other two if we have time. But I cried for 20 minutes solid. And here I was finishing an assignment on grief. Almost finished my diploma. And this visited our door on the Saturday. I know this is very much our story. We cocooned ourselves. When you begin to kind of come back in half an hour later to what really happened, we needed to make sure we told our kids. And we all decided that my parents and siblings and partners, we'd just go to my sister's house. Half the family live outside of Dublin and the rest of us live in Dublin. We all just got together within an hour in my sister's house. And we just sat there around the table. And our partners and our spouses were phenomenal that day. They made tea for us. They sat with us, they listened to us, and they just allowed the 6 of us, or the 5 of us, just to go, what the hell is this all about? About 6-7 hours later, really close friends began to kind of pop in, and the news began to get out there of what was going on. And it was 6 hours. I know it's not everybody's story, but if something like that happens, get your close ones around you as quick as possible. Get into that cocoon and a safe place to go. Sometimes we just sat there in silence. Yeah. Sometimes we sat there eating. People were dropping in and out.
It's shocking, really.
At times, believe it or not, at times we even laughed about things just to break the tension.
Of course you do.
So that was the Saturday. And then we had to kick into you know, funeral and wake and what about this? And so you got this unbelievable, stupid, crazy, mad news. And then it's, but what will you want to wear in the coffin? And what readings will we have? And who's head, you know, so you're straddling this craziness going on. Now, we were in it together. Absolutely in it together. So Kira and myself arranged the funeral mass. Others looked after other elements of it. It's like we all played our role in it, and we had the wake in our house on the Tuesday night. Rock and rollers were coming out of the woodwork. Old friends were coming out. It was an amazing time in some ways, and me kind of hobbling around in these bloody crutches, wanted to be in the middle of it all. So we waked them in our house, which is a real privilege. We can have that as a family. Yeah. And I remember coming down in the morning, hobbling down the stairs, and he was laid out in the sitting room. And before I went into the family and into the kitchen, I just went into the coffin and I just put my hand on it and I said, "Big day ahead, bro." So then you have to fall into the practicals of, you know, the funeral. That was, the church was packed. Like, it was a big church and it was absolutely packed. The standout moment for that was at the very end, Mum and Dad did the eulogy. And they stood up in front of everybody. And that was only, that was decided as they were leaving their house to come to ours the morning of the funeral for us all to travel together. They were a discussion in the car going, "We'll do it together, we'll not do it together." They both stood up and gave a eulogy of Andrew, and unbelievable. You know, I don't know where they got the strength to talk about their son the way they did. And at the very end, they asked the congregation, would you all pray for us now, please? And I'm like, oh, jeepers, we're sitting there looking at these two people who've lost their son under such horrendous circumstances. And this is, you know, they're actually caring for all of us in this. So buried them. The next time I cried, and this was the hardest part of me, because I was on crutches, I couldn't carry him out of the church. Yeah. So my other brothers and brothers-in-law were carrying, and I was hobbling behind, and I was going, I couldn't even carry him. Like, emotionally, or practically the weeks before, and now I can't even carry him when he's dead, and I bawled my eyes leaving the church.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, isn't it? Because that's very significant to you, and an outsider looking in probably wouldn't have took any notice. Oh, he's on crutches, whatever. But like, it's certain things in the funeral ritual that are so important.
Absolutely.
To people.
Absolutely. I think it's why we
do. It's a big deal.
The rituals are so important, and we don't realise them. The waking, the mourning, the funeral, the graveyard, the sandwiches and soup afterwards, the depending on your faith, whatever, the month's mind, that was all about bringing the community back together again around the family 4 weeks on, because very quickly people move back into their lives, and all of a sudden, like, you're coming back from the pub we were in, and you see buses go by and you see people on bikes and you're going, life is going on.
But, well, I'm beeping the horn at you. And you're exactly. Like, do you not realise what's just happened?
Exactly. Yeah. 100%. So you're straddling this craziness, normal life and absolute
It's funny
madness.
Also that I just noticed that you say, you know, it kind of makes me laugh somewhat that, you know, you get this devastating news and then it's like, right, what are they going to wear? And what are we going to sing? And it's everyone that has listened to this that has lost someone understands that. And we just go, okay, and let's do this and let's do that. Yeah. It's just wild.
Yeah.
You know, it's bizarre because then you have those moments and you sit down and you're like, oh my God. And like that tender moment that you said when you go in that morning, you know. And, you know, as you say, I agree with you, those the month's minds, all those, because I really feel like people lift you, just their presence, just being there. Mm. You feel cared for. It's really important, isn't it?
Oh, people, you know, were absolutely phenomenal. Two phone calls and people were coming in and said, "We look after all the catering for the week." Done. People came and cleaned our house because I couldn't. Yeah. Done. The support, my college friends at that time were unbelievable. Like, we buried Andrew on a Wednesday and I was due back in college the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and the Thursday I was going, I couldn't. The last thing I need is people. And suddenly Thursday night I went, I need to be around these people.
Yeah.
And like that, hobbled in on crutches, and they just, many of them had been at the funeral, they just held me. There was no big talk. It was just, yep, you're here, get on with what we need to learn.
Pat on the back kind of
thing.
Pat
on the back. And, you know, and there was and those people know who they are, that just absolutely messaged me regularly, held me, finished college with them, really close family friends who, there was somebody who messaged me every week for about 4 months.
Wow.
Thinking of you, hope you're doing okay. The check-ins, for all of us. All of us as siblings and my parents experienced that from many different people, and especially those who had lost people. So those days after, you need the community to hold you.
Mm-hmm.
You're holding yourself together as a family. And again, I have to say, Kira and the five kids were phenomenal. Because for 4 months, I would imagine, if not longer, I was just angry. I didn't grieve. I was angry.
Just went to anger straight away.
Anger. And I went from anger to about 6 months later to sadness, going, what a waste. Why aren't you singing? Why aren't you here? You got your two kids. We were here. You know? So you move from anger to sadness, but not sadness as in I miss you, the sadness of the lost opportunities. But Kira and the kids just sailed, you know, with me in those times.
People are, you know, you see the best of people, the best. You know, it almost makes you think, why can't people be like this all the time? Yeah. Why do you have to, like, you know, cut me off in traffic and be, you know, it's like, and then you see the absolute best in people at times like this. So we have it in us, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, your family are everything, and they're the ones that you count on really at the end of the day. They'll always be there. Yeah. Like, and it's amazing that you had that.
Oh, absolutely.
There.
And again, the craziness and madness, buried Andrew at the end of May.
Yeah.
We had a wedding eight weeks later.
Yeah.
So we were kind of, and Andrew was meant to be playing the music at that.
You feel a bit, you know, were you struggling? Well, obviously you were, you know, so sidestruck with this whole thing, but, you know, because it's your daughter's wedding, was there a sense of like, oh God, you know, we want to keep it happy for her? Yeah. And that's a struggle to do
it
that.
It was a mindset more than anything else. We were like, okay, this has happened. And I think again, because our immediate family, wider family, were holding each other, and then underneath that, the community were holding us. It propelled us to keep moving forward. And it was a determination to go, yeah, we're going to have to straddle the grief and the upset, but this is a brilliant occasion. And it was a brilliant occasion. It was a beautiful summer's day. Yeah. The reception was in the same reception that Kira and myself had our reception in.
Wow.
So I'm standing there now as father of the bride giving a speech. And the last time I gave a speech in that room was
at my own
wedding. You know, so you have to capture these moments. And again, we acknowledged Andrew during the day.
Yeah.
He was part of the ceremony. He was part of the crack. His band members stepped in and did the music for us completely free that night, which was phenomenal. So we had a great wedding. We just knew grief is part of this, but it's only part of it now. And we had a wonderful celebration. It wasn't tinged with sadness or regret. And again, we all just pulled together as a family.
Wow.
Without saying anything, we were just all there to have a good time. This is a celebration, and this is where life needs to keep moving forward.
You do learn that as you go, don't you? That, like, celebrations will come up all of the time. And I mean, I think it's particularly hard when it's so raw and so recent. It's really hard to get through those days. But you do it, and you get on, and you know, you put the face on and you do what you have to do. And in some ways, I know myself personally, I have never loved celebrations as much since the loss of my sister. And like, now I'm like, oh my God, it's my birthday. What are we doing? I never used to do that before. I'm like, oh, it's grand, forget about it. But now I'm like, let's get everyone. Let's all have a party. So I'm glad that you got through that okay and had a lovely time. Special.
And COVID kind of interrupted some of our, because that was, you know, his Beck's partner was February, Andrew was May, wedding was July, and then by you know, the next March we were all kind of locked down. And stuff like that, and
that's when the real stuff probably
and we were kind of isolated, and Christmas was a big time for us as a family, so that was kind of interrupted. And then when can we be together, not together? So last May it was 4 years, was his anniversary, and all of us said that this was the hardest one,
right?
For some reason, maybe because everything was back to normal.
Yeah.
And we could be together. It was, even though we'd been together before, this year hit us all a little bit harder. And it, you know, which was really, really strange. We were trying to figure it out. We couldn't figure it out. There's no point in trying to make sense of it. We just all acknowledged that this year was
particularly hard.
As soon as May comes around, because like there's a number of family birthdays in May, and there's Andrew's birthday and its anniversary in May. So all what we've all experienced is that May comes around, it's like, oh, crap. Okay, you're right. You get through it.
Do you feel it? I don't know. This is just kind of my own bouncing it off you. Mm. Like, I feel like the body can physically remember that every year, mm-hmm. especially a traumatic one. So my sister obviously was ill, mm-hmm. but my brother-in-law, her husband, died in an mm-hmm. accident. And I, every October, I'm like, oh my God, I'm so anxious. I'm sorry. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. And like this year, my partner, he's my husband now.
Yeah.
He was laughing at me. He was like, hello, it's October. And I'm like, oh my God, I do this every year.
Yeah.
Every mm-hmm. year I get tight in my chest. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think your subconscious goes back into that 100%. Build up.
Yeah. It's the emotional memory. Like we have all the memories of the time and the pictures in our mind and where we were and what we were wearing and all that. But 4 years on, our emotions remember what we were feeling at that time.
Oh my God, I never thought of that. Yes.
They remember what so May means. So yes,
your conscious memories, your thoughts, but
the emotional memory is being held, and that's what comes up for us. Going, oh yeah, the emotions are remembering this, and wow. This might be the trauma with the small t piece. Is that part of my moving through this grief? Again, this is very personal because everybody's done it differently. Is I've had to learn to literally time. I've had to learn to incorporate this into my life. This isn't going away. This isn't like a fever or a sickness that will peak, you'll get better, recover, and then you'll move on from. So the first 3-4 months, anger, the next period of time, sadness, remembering other things that kind of, you know, came up for me during that time. But in the meantime, we've had 2 weddings, 3 granddaughters. So life has got bigger for us.
Mm-hmm.
The grief is still there, but it's not ruling the roost.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much more has been poured into our lives that has made life great, and kids graduating and getting jobs or maybe moving away and new friendships and career changes. So life moves on, and if it can get bigger, the grief will always be there.
Mm.
And it, you know, it showed up, as I said, I've only cried 3 times, the phone call from Dad, not carrying Andrew. And it was about 1.5 years later, again, Saturday morning, got a message on my phone and email to say that a really good friend of ours had just died in his sleep in London.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen him for a while. He was a good friend. We'd known him for many, many years. And he was older, but it was still like that. And this is where the emotional memory comes in. Yeah. Saturday morning, lunchtime, suddenly, you know, those things yep. hit here. And Kieran myself had things planned. We're actually going in to see friends for lunch on that Saturday afternoon. And all of a sudden I became narky. I went and I was like, that's really sad. And to hear, you know, Bruce pass away, oh, that's really sad, really sad. And all of a sudden we were driving in the car. I'd become really narky the next hour or two. And we were driving in the car and Kieran said, are you okay? And I was like, so that's the next time I cried. I said, this is what's going on for me. The emotions are remembering.
Yeah.
Phone call, sudden. Saturday morning, all the associations
triggered, as we
totally,
call it,
totally triggered. So I had to go, oh, this is what happens. So the way I describe it, and if it's of any help to the people, it's okay to have those cries.
Yeah.
It's okay to go, this is a crap morning, and that's why our feelings, our thoughts about grief and the grief you've experienced have to be honored when they show up. They're going to show up. They you cannot go around grief. You have to go through grief.
And sometimes we try to swallow it back down, but that eats away at your insides.
Absolutely.
Like, doesn't it? Just holding on to it.
Absolutely.
I always feel great after a cry. I'm like, sometimes I'm like, oh my God. Sometimes I put on YouTube videos of soldiers returning home. Just to get it out.
My go-to is music. There's certain songs that I will put on and they'll
it'll
just
come out.
They'll just allow the emotions to rise. Usually you actually listen to Andrew.
Of course.
Again, that's a weird one in the family. You know, some of the family, they you know, can't even look at pictures of him or hear his music. Yeah. I have no problem listening to his music, but there's other things I can't do. I've not been really to the grave.
Yeah,
I can't go there. Listen to him on YouTube or some of his songs give me that bit of comfort. Yeah, that's where the grief might come in, where there's no anger or there's no sadness. It's all right. OK,
you're just grieving him.
I'm just grieving him. I'm just missing him and his music.
It's like I had a conversation with another girl here last week, but she was saying that your grief is so precious to you. It's like it's yours and it belongs to you. Mm-hmm. And that being able to sit with it and, as you said, not just have anger or sadness or what, but just to grieve is like it's a healthy thing to do.
Very healthy. Yeah. Very healthy. And what has helped me, because sometimes I think I try to avoid it. Or we try to avoid it. We don't want to feel it. We don't want it to come up. And the only visual that it's helped me is, and it's a physical thing as well, is that when it rises, it's like walking into the Irish Sea. And, you know, you feel the cold on the ankles and in the knees and in the midriff and the chest. And it's that, you know, as it comes and it hits you and you realise it and you go, this is freezing. This is uncomfortable. This is cold. But then you can leave the sea.
Mm.
So for me, even talking here now,
the
waves have come and I've just gone, okay, take
that's
a minute,
fine.
Take a breath. It's the cold sea hitting me. I've recognized it, honor the feelings that I'm angry, sad, I miss them, it's still in me, and then the waves will go back out again and I'll continue talking to you and then I'll go about my day's work after here. So that really helps me when it comes to the grief of see it as that cold wave that just hits the stomach or the chest where you go, you're okay for a while and then it just hits, but it goes. And actually we are stronger than we think we are in getting through this. We're more resilient than we think we are in times like this.
You're spot on. You know, I often to have grief retreats and stuff, but my message normally to them is, you know, if you cry this weekend, if any of you say, sorry for getting upset, I'll literally like come down there and like have a go at you. Because the way I've said it to them is, would you ever say, oh my God, I'm sorry for laughing. I'm sorry for getting so happy. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. Like, why do we say, Sorry. When you start wiping your tears, and then of course inevitably I will do it and they'll all laugh and go, you said it, can't say sorry. But yeah, I think we're a bit uncomfortable with it still, the whole showing emotion, letting it out, but it's so healthy. And you're spot on, is that it's hard because it takes your breath away and you're not expecting it. And but one thing I wanted to maybe touch on is, you know, I have had guests on the podcast and a lot of people talking about the goodbye and being there and being able to be with your person when they're dying and all of that. And then there's the other side of people who don't get to say goodbye, who have a traumatic sudden death like yourselves. And it's so uniquely different. It's just a different experience. I have, I suppose, witness both myself, a long, painful goodbye and no goodbye. I found personally there's an awful lot of trauma and shock, and I do have that trigger thing if I see a helicopter and stuff like that with my brother-in-law. I everything changes, my heart tightens. But for you, I suppose, just to kind of, you know, speak on that, did you battle with the no goodbye?
I think it was interesting. I didn't get to say goodbye, but Andrew came and said goodbye to me.
Oh, wow.
It was 2 weeks after the operation and I was sitting at home. It was a Sunday evening and like that, the foot was up. And I think Kier had to go away that weekend or something. She wasn't around for a day or two. And out of the blue, Andrew arrived at the door on Sunday evening about 7 o'clock. And he came in and there's our three-seater, our two-seater, and then we've this red chair. Doesn't match anything in the room. We've got this red chair that one of our kids in particular liked and we just left it there. And so I was sitting here with the leg up and Andrew was sitting in the red chair. And he stayed about half an hour and, how's the leg? How you doing? And yeah, that's fine. And they said he was flat maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, no, just wanted to come in and, you know, see how the leg was and that. And then he left. And then like that, got on with what we needed to get on with, et cetera, et cetera. And then Saturday morning, got the phone call from Dad. And it was only later on I went, he came and said goodbye. Because the question had been going around in my mind, did he plan this? Or was this just a spur of the moment, like literally a break and was done? My reflection is that it was planned. Maybe not the exact time or date, but it was. And I suddenly went, okay, he said goodbye to me. But I didn't get to say goodbye to him. And you do begin to remember those last few conversations. You kind of go, God, you know, should I have been more supportive? Should I have been more in his face and going after him? But you kind of go, but do I have the right to do that? And we've both lived independent lives. So the multitude of questions.
My next question for you was, you know, suicide. Is it just a never ending question after question after question after question after question?
For a long time.
Yeah.
It's a long, and that's something you learn to or try to manage over time, but it's just, it's like an intrusion, it's like a flood. It's like somebody's burst a pipe and it just keeps coming. You can't, it's find it very hard to plug it because you're going, what about this? And why did he do that? This is crazy. And, you know, I thought everything was okay. And what happens is you there's movement. And then in the year preceding, all those firsts you had to go through, birthdays, Christmases, anniversaries, etc. But because of suicide, and again, anybody who's probably experienced this, because he had been in an institution, we had to have a couple of meetings with them about the care.
Right.
So a lot was rehashed there. But I only learned at that meeting that actually the week before he had passed, he had actually done two attempts.
Wow.
And I didn't know that. Until 7 or 8 months later. Nobody's fault. But I'm sitting here in this meeting and somebody made a comment, yeah, well, like, he had the previous attempts and then he was this. And I was like, what? So one or two family members, and no grudge held at all.
Yeah,
it was
just
like, so months in, it hits again. And then again with suicide, what you don't expect is the coroner's report.
Yes.
You have to go in and relive it. And what I found out there was that the place where he went to end his life was his recording studio. Because we could time his phone went off somewhere after midnight. He said he was wanting to meet some friends in town for a couple of drinks. And next morning, mum and dad, you know, he wasn't at home. And dad, being the fireman, I think immediately went, okay. So, sorry, going back to the Friday evening, he arrived at the recording studio, phone turned off, but there was CCTV. So the coroner and the guard who was, you know, was on site on the Saturday morning had to watch that hour of CCTV and see the whole thing unfold because they needed to make sure they had to get all their facts in a line.
Sure.
Nobody else involved,
yeah.
Substance, etc., etc. So you kind of go, the whole thing was videoed. And there's this sick little tiny part of you go, would I like to have seen that?
I know.
This is the stupidity and the craziness and the madness of grief. Because you go to these mad places because there might be an answer there. I can't get an answer there, but I might get an answer here. So it flashed my mind going, if somebody gave me that DVD, I'd probably watch it because they'll give me something back. Now, others, you know, may not. So you have the initial wave of this grief and months of it, and with suicide, and depending obviously on the circumstances of somebody's death, with suicide, there was other, you had to keep going back and revisiting for a while. And the coroner's report, again, it was during COVID, that could be a year or a year and a half later.
Yeah.
So again, I would have loved to have gone into that, but it was limited to certain numbers because I think I was looking for, it wasn't necessarily information, I was just looking for closure on certain things. So it was relentless, it was endless, it was intrusive, but you're trying to go to a wedding, you're trying to have a holiday, you're trying to raise the rest of your kids, you're trying to be married, you're trying to be who you are in life and work. It's hugely influenced my work. Like, grief is a huge part of my work and in my practice. And I'm very comfortable sitting with that with people. Very, if they come in, I've done my work on it, and so I can sit with that really well. In fact, I think it helps to sit with it, to sit with others' grief as well. Now, 4 years later, I've just realized it's time. And my new saying is, now is not forever. There's now, and it's horrible and it's crap and I don't get it, but now isn't forever.
Yeah.
Because the sun rose today and it'll go down tonight.
And tomorrow's a new day.
And it'll start again. And as the weeks roll by and the months roll by, and now 4 years out, yes, talking to you, it still rises in me. But the bucket of my life is so much more in it than grief. There's so much more great things in it, and life has moved on, that then is not forever. Andrew's death was, you know, coldly, it was an event that happened in May. We're still living with it now, but I'm living life in 2023. So for me, now is not forever. Now is now. Yeah. And I'm trying to deal with it now. But the now will become tomorrow and the next day. And it'll just, it's just feeling different as the weeks and months roll on.
Mm. So the, you know, with suicide, do you find that there is still so much stigma? Did you find silence around it, that people perhaps maybe in some cases avoided you? People aren't confident to bring it up or mention it. Do you find people didn't want to talk about Andrew? Or, yeah.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. I think people's way of asking how I was, how are your parents? And I knew exactly what they meant, because they're right, because they lost
anyone
a son.
Anyone but you.
Yeah. How are your parents doing?
And of course, yeah,
and of course, mum and dad are phenomenal. Mum and dad are amazing. Mum and dad are supporting us. But it was there, oh, you know, how it be it in the grocery shop, on the street, or how are your parents doing? So I
his kids probably.
Yeah, absolutely. How are the kids
doing?
I've
lost sibling too, and we get that as well. How's your parents? How are the boys? I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Exactly. Yeah. Now there were those who weren't, who knew.
There's
gratings might be the wrong word. There are those who will just go there with you and they'll make a mess of it. And there's others who might just be a bit more difficult. They don't know what to say. Yeah. I would offer it's okay to say the wrong thing, because on a reflection, people will go, at least it was acknowledged and it was nice. Now looking back, it was a really funny incident, but it was about, I know I was back driving because I was up with somebody. And something to do with the car, and this particular person was trying to explain something to me, but as they were explaining it, they were trying to teach me something about the car as well, and what about this and what about that, and I eventually got there as I was talking to this person. They turned around and they said, and they were right in the middle of the grief of it all, and he turned around and said, I just wanted to give you enough rope to and he absolutely cringed.
Oh no.
And again, it hits you and you go, it's fine, it's grand, I know what you mean. Now I acknowledge going, but see, all of a sudden the ordinary sayings in life,
I know,
you know,
it's everywhere. I know, anytime I have spoke with anybody who's lost someone to suicide, you're like, oh my God, did I just say that? I'll kill you. Like, and you panic.
I know, you catch yourself going, oh, I just feel like killing myself. And you go, oh, well, that takes on a whole new meaning now, you know, later on, or a rope, or died under suspicious circumstances. Mm. You kind of probably could pick what that means, you know, or what you read into what's not said, and you wonder. So overall, honestly, people were absolutely amazing. And most of the time in there with you, a handful might have just been, don't know what to do here, or they'll go the parent route or the children route. What we did, because, you know, in the study of grief and in the life of grief, a huge part of it is to try and find meaning in some of this. And it's not as though answers, meaning is very different to answers. Answers are, why did he do it? And, you know, what was the meaning is, what am I going to do with my life because of this event? So we have the memories of him. His two beautiful kids are still very much involved in our lives, and I still love his music. His influence and impact on the world is still there to hear. Absolutely. And what we did last May and the previous May is that we have decided that my parents, my two older sisters, myself and my two younger brothers, around the time of the anniversary, that Friday, Saturday, we just go away. And we meet for lunch down in Glendalough, and we have lunch and we sit outside and we talk and we laugh and we share, and that's what we're doing as a family. We're not letting it tear us apart or determine who we are. We're using it as something to bring us together again. So the focus is not Andrew. He's the reason we're coming together. But we each go around the table going, Mum and Dad, how are you? Mum, how are you? Because Mum and Dad are totally different in their grief in this,
of course,
which is fine.
Yeah.
And we just let it all out. We don't hold back. And I love that honesty between us. I love the fact that we can do that.
You know, when events like that happen, some families, it's absolutely like getting a bomb, and they can all just go, everyone just dissipates, and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of times the family is kind of no more. There is, people are stuck in their grief. There's a lot of anger, there's a lot of misplaced anger, and it can really shatter some families. Yeah. I like to think, listening to you, your parents sound like they are, I suppose, the head of the family in many ways, and they obviously, but they, even the start of the conversation, you're saying it was so important that you all came together, even though you're all over. And that's kind of what's continued because of that. It was in place before anything ever happened. You know, it's the values of your family that it's important that we stick together, we come together. And it's lovely to hear that you are all still gathering, and you obviously get a lot of comfort out of that and support being together. You know?
Very much so. Very much. And
it's lovely.
You kind of, it happens naturally in many ways, and then you're intentional about it in other ways. Like you make specific times, you know, for each other. Again, during COVID, you try and meet in parks and go for a walk together, or the distance stuff. But yeah, mum and dad kind of held it together. And I do totally, totally acknowledge that any passing and then the complication of suicide can be devastating for many families.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely devastating. And if it's okay to say, well, that time when we all cocooned together, those first 6 hours, at times I was sitting beside my mum and times she was opposite me, we were kind of moving around, and sometimes she'd be sitting there going, no, no, no. Like, she just couldn't, she was speaking against it. She couldn't fathom it. And I was kind of watching my dad's grief, I was watching my siblings' grief, my own grief, and I'm watching, but I couldn't take my eyes off my mum. And anytime we were together, I was drawn to her from an emotional point of view, going, okay, like, whatever about dad and whatever about us as brothers and sisters, but what the heck is mum experiencing here? Like, she bore him, gave birth to him, nursed him, bathed, clothed, fed, drove him everywhere, as she did with all of us. And then this to be the end? Like, dads, we can go into our heads and kind of, you know, kind of maybe factualize, but that womb, that's grief in the womb, that is. And that's what I was seeing with my mum. And with my therapist's head on, I was going, now this might be way down the line, but I was so curious, going, I'd love to go and have the opportunity to talk to the mums of Ireland who have lost a child to suicide, going, would you mind please telling me what that was like for you? Of course, dads, and so, like, it's not to negate anybody else's, but just for me, those early months, I just couldn't, like, I was trying to think, losing one of my kids, I couldn't, but like a mum, whatever the relationship might have been like, a mum, that's
an instinctual thing. You know, I just spoke with a woman who had lost her son. And, you know, she explained that, she said it's like a primal thing. Just the noise that comes out.
Oh, absolutely.
I've heard that from a couple of mums who've lost a child, that it's just, and I mean primal, because when you look at mothers, animals in nature, just the instinct of mothering and feeding and nurturing and all, like, it's just, it goes against all.
I go to the lioness who will just do anything.
Savage.
They will be savage for the kids, yet they'll be that incredible comfort of kind of wrapping their children into them. They do both so well. I couldn't get that out of my mind for a long time. I said, okay, but I'll put that there and see. Because again, you know, there's brilliant supports out there now for families who have lost, you know, kind of family members or friends, you know, the suicide. There's lots of group things, there's lots of support. But and there's no piece of research you can do that's going to all of a sudden slow suicide down. It's part of our society, it's part of our lives for whatever reason. And there's many contributing factors probably. There's just something about the bracket of a mum's grief that won't leave me. That's a bit curious. And maybe in
that's
time.
Something you need to... You know, especially in your career, I mean, it's something that you absolutely could, you know, look into and specialise and look at it.
Maybe. It's not with the goal of solving suicide or even major support.
Understanding.
It's understanding. Yeah. And I think when you tell your story, It's very healing telling your story.
Yeah.
Incredibly healing. Mm-hmm. Just to get it out there. Like the amount of people who sit opposite me, and what a privilege I have each day that people sit opposite me and they tell me their story, and then they come back a while later and go, I just felt better. Because yeah, I could come to a place and just, you see, when you come to a private place like a therapist room or whatever, you're not worried. It's not friend, parent, brother, uncle, aunt sitting opposite you. It's a completely neutral sounding board. And you can say whatever you want about grief. You can call it whatever name you want to. You can curse at it. You can scream at it. You can cry at it. Where sometimes in other situations, you might be playing a role and you
might have to share it as well.
Exactly.
Saying, I can't take full ownership because this is your son, or this is this was your dad, or, you know, kind of have to dilute your grief.
In some ways, absolutely. And measure it with either the person or other people in the room. Where when you can come
to therapy,
you can just sit opposite somebody and,
and it's all yours.
You curse and scream away there for the next 10 minutes.
It belongs to you.
It belongs to you. It's your expression. You've honoured the feelings
in you. It's so true. Like, you know, it's important for people to kind of understand that. Maybe if they're thinking, I'm doing okay, I don't really need therapy or whatever. I never felt like I needed it for my grief because I'm a talker.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was like, you sit in that corner and listen to me for the next 3 hours.
Yeah,
and they're more than you, like husband now. Oh my God, what a saint that man is. But for therapy, I get the question all the time. Can you recommend, you know? And I've just kind of realised there, I'm like, that's why I suppose it is so special, is because it's hard to weigh somebody down and it's hard to share it because other people are feeling it. But if you go to therapy, it is 100% yours.
The focus is only on you.
Yeah, that's
and
amazing.
What you,
and you need that.
What you say and what you express is very, very safe to do. There's going to be no judgment, no criticism, no, oh, what should you have done? It's like, give me more.
Yeah.
Almost like dig deep and let it all out. Because then you have it all out on the table.
Yeah.
And you're able to kind of go, okay, what do I need to bring with me? What do I not need to carry anymore? It's just that relief that's there. And a lot of people experience that when they suddenly go, yeah, because I couldn't have had this conversation with anybody else, or the freedom of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, we all play roles and we all have responsibilities. We're all either, you know, looking up to somebody or somebody's looking up to us. So, you know, it's measured slightly differently, where if you have the opportunity to just go to a place where, I know nothing about you, so tell me everything. It's very, very incredibly freeing. And the beauty of it is, it might only be once or twice, because then you just have to live life.
Oh, listen, I have a therapist there and I'm like, girl, you're staying here.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm like, I want to rant. I don't have any specific issue I'm dealing with at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I found her and I love her. So therefore, I'm like, I ring her once a week. Every now and again, I'll say, right, we'll take 3 weeks off. I love her. I do it actually by Zoom. So it's so handy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time together. But I honestly could talk to you for a long, 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 long time. And obviously your career now is therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Where can people find you? What's the name of your business?
So it's ByYourSideTherapy.com, Facebook.
Yeah, I'll share everything in the show notes. Yeah. But I just want to say thank you so much for coming, because it's really important, first of all, to talk about suicide and loss of our people to suicide. Mm-hmm. And it's such stigma. And not alone that, but I think there's still a lot of men find it really difficult to talk and to share their emotions. And so I honestly feel like right now, to me, you feel like a role model to a lot of men, to be able to speak and tell your story and cry and whatever it is, feel all the feelings. I think you're a role model, and I think you're really a special person to be able to come in and share that difficult pain. And just, I suppose, normalize it in a way, in that, like, this does happen and it's okay. Mm. And it's okay to talk about it. It's okay to be devastated.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for your very kind words. Just thank you for it. It's been like a free therapy session for me to get it all out there. I feel wonderful now.
I'm delighted.
So no, in all seriousness, though, thank you. Just to be able to talk about a really difficult subject that just needs to be able to be, it's okay to talk. It's okay to talk about it. It's okay to use the word suicide.
Absolutely.
It's not a dirty word.
Name
it's not
it.
A bad word.
Yeah.
Just name it and own it. I thank you for all that you do in your work in bringing this area, because it's some of it is still underground in some ways. We just get on with stuff. So thank you for highlighting and shining a light and wonderful to have this time with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Well, this conversation is going to stay with me forever. Peter was so generous in his sharing so openly and honestly about what it's like to lose a loved one to suicide. I think by doing so, he is helping to remove the stigma that really exists still around suicide, and also to show men that it's okay to openly discuss your pain and emotions. You can find out more about Peter on Instagram at @ByYourSideTherapy and on his website, ByYourSideTherapy.com. If you enjoyed this podcast today, please don't forget to subscribe or follow, rate, most importantly, share it with your friends, and I will speak to you next time.